knew that if you went to school, you will have some means to support yourself if life showed up, which life does, right, on their own terms. And so we have a saying, you know, if you say, estudie para que sea alguien algún día, like study so that you can be someone one day. And I did.
This is a podcast called Walk, Talk, Listen. An attempt to connect people and make this world a bit better by sharing opinions and experiences based on the belief that everyone's perspective is true, albeit partial. My name is Maurice Bloem, and I would like to welcome you to yet another episode of Walk, Talk. Okay, good day, everybody. This is another episode of the podcast Walk, Talk, Listen. And as always, I'm delighted with today's guest who will introduce herself. Alejandra, please go ahead.
Hi, Maurice. Thank you for the invitation. My name is Alejandra Schrader, and I am a plant-based nutrition certified chef. I'm an author, an entrepreneur, food TV personality, and also an activist. And I'm based in Los Angeles, California.
Yeah. And we met with each other for the first time in New York last week, I think. This is 2 weeks ago. I don't know exactly. Where I listened to your presentation, and then I found out that you had written a book. So I'm so delighted to be able to speak with you today. What the listeners know, what I always try to do, Alejandra, is go back to the roots. You live in Los Angeles now, but that's not where you were born and you were raised. So can you tell us a bit about it?
Yes, I am a true citizen of the world. Mm. I was born here in the States, actually. I was born in Chicago, Illinois. Most people don't know that. And my accent doesn't make it easy to guess either. Mm. During the nationalization of the oil industry in mm-hmm. Venezuela, the place I call home, they sent a large number of professionals to get trained here in America before they went back home and they took over the industry, which at the time in the 70s, it had been managed by American oil companies. Mm. And so it was really a thought of luck. That allowed me to be born in this country, even though before I was a year old, my parents already returned to Venezuela. Okay. And so I was raised in Caracas, the capital of the country. We did not have the financial means to visit America. So, and for a one parenthesis, I'll skip over, I didn't come back to my birthplace until I was in my 20s. Okay. And so I, you know, Caracas was home. Spanish was the only language that I learned, Castilian, the Spanish, the only language that I spoke at home. And I made it as far as halfway through university. And so I lived in a we would like to say a middle low income household, but in retrospect, it was probably a little closer to low. Mm-hmm. My father left, and so my mother, who was a doctor in pharmaceutics, had to support three daughters, and and so financial security and food security was not there all the time. However, because my mother was the first college educated person in her family, she knew that if you went to school, you will have some means to support yourself if life showed up, which life does, right? Yeah. On their own terms. And so we have a saying, you know, if you say, estudie para que sea alguien algún día, like study so that you can be someone one day. And I did. I studied. She kept us in private schools. It was very hard, but she did. Mm. And so when I graduated from high school, I started studying architecture in our main public university, which is free, but also the best the Universidad Central de Venezuela, and I studied architecture there.
And why did you choose architecture?
Architecture had always been that one thing I wanted to be. My father was an engineer, and both my older sisters were civil engineers. I had a household of civil engineers. And I had been to construction sites. The few years that my father did stick around, I had access to going to construction sites, and I was fascinated by that. You know, I was that kid playing Legos, but I loved the design aspect. Like, I wanted to create. I didn't want it to build. I wanted to design. And they say, at least at home, that architecture is that one career where your right brain and your left side of the brain get activated. So that's why I had no doubt that that's what I wanted to be. And it was the only thing I ever wanted to study.
Wow. And so so when you were finished, because I know where you end up, right? So I know that you're now a chef.
Oh, God. I mean, the four career changes later. So actually what happened was in 1998, the political situation in Venezuela got very difficult, which made the economic situation very difficult. And being the third child, I had to see my mother struggle and work so hard. And architecture is a very expensive career in Venezuela, at least. Well, here too. But my mom had to pay for the materials, the balsa wood, for me to build the models. And eventually I just felt really guilty that I was putting that strain on her. And so halfway, I was in the sixth semester out of 10 in architecture school. And I was like, well, you know, I am an American citizen by birth. And the embassy at the time had great outreach programs to citizens in Venezuela. And so I talked to someone and they said, well, you know, if you come, you can get financial aid. And just that idea that I could use financial aid to pay for my education and not have to continue to get money from my mother was really enough of a motivation for me to say, like, you know what, I'm going to go try it out.
Yeah, sure.
So my mother sold her 1978 LTD Londo Ford, a very old car, for $500. And so she paid for a one-way ticket for me to fly to Miami, and she gave me $250 cash. And that's how I moved back to the States.
Oh. Oh. But your other two sisters stayed in Venezuela.
They stayed.
So you were the only
Venezuela.
One that went.
Yes, they were both college graduated. My oldest sister had a very successful career in the oil, in the national oil company, PDVSA. And I was the only one, you know, like I was the last one. And so I think I would have done so many things differently. It's just what you don't know, you don't know. And I had to learn English before I could finish university. So I started going to ESL, and in order to have a very well foundation of English in order for you to go to college, as you can imagine, it wasn't just like conversational English, and I knew nothing. When they did the placement test, I placed at zero. So I had to do like 3 years of ESL before I was able to transfer to a four-year college. And even then, I didn't get transfer all the credits because the systems of construction in both countries are so different. I had never seen a wood beam in my life. You know, we build reinforced concrete. So I had to sort of like get set back a little bit. And then I finished. I went to a very good school. It's called the Southern California Institute of Architecture, SIAR. And it's one of the top 10 architecture schools in the world. And very proud that I went there.
And what did you do in those 3 years that you were working on your English?
Oh, my goodness. So I worked, my first job was at a supermarket, graveyard shift, because I couldn't really understand the money system. It couldn't make sense to me that the dime was smaller than the nickel and things like that, right? you know, you're in customer service, but you don't speak the language. I mostly just focus on on the schooling, I knew that was an intricate part of me making the transition now into living, in America. And so I took 18 credits, sometimes more per semester. And then, you know, I worked to, you know, to provide and produce for myself. But it was a great journey. And also I also tried to understand the lot, you know, like how people live here and try to, you know, like it's a whole shift in perspective when you come to a new country. And so it was great in ESL because I could befriend people that were not English speakers, but that were from other countries. And so my first like little entourage was someone from Israel, someone from France, and someone from Japan. And we had to speak English to each other precisely because we didn't know a common language.
That's a great story. So then, you know, you're done with your study.
I finished architecture school. At the time that I finished architecture school, a man that is pivotal in my life, he was a mentor. He was my boss. I was an intern in his company. And this is probably the closest thing I will ever know to having a father. He became, you know, he was a boss. I became a mentor, an academic mentor. And when I graduated from SciArc, again, you know, one of the best, and by the way, I was the valedictorian of my graduating class. Yeah. And so it just, you know, it was so important because for Venezuelans, like academic means so much, you know. And he said, you know, the economy is really bad right now. And now that you're graduating, normally you'll go out into, you know, the corporate world. But the economy is really bad right now. So what I suggest is that you stay in school, you go get a master's degree, to wait until the economy, you know, comes back. And also you'll have this degree. I never in my life thought I would get a master's degree. And this man empowered me. He made me feel that it was a possibility for me against all odds. And so I applied for the University of Michigan, go blue, and I got in. And so I went to do a master's in urban and regional planning with focus in sustainability.
Wow. Yeah. Okay. So now I slowly understand why you wrote a book as you did.
Right.
So
it wasn't a straight line. Right. No. And I think that the way that I can bridge that gap and without having to tell all the stories is, you know, life showed up. The economic took turns up and down. Mm-hmm. When I got out of grad school, it wasn't great either, but I was able to enter the work field. And I was very grateful to work for private companies where I learned a lot, where I was able to go up that ladder, where I had new mentors that took me under their wing. And I learned so much. And, you know, I was building 10,000 acres communities full of, you know, a single use and multifamily, you know, use, but then it took another turn. And so as I lost my job, as everyone was losing a job in the real estate development land planning field in 2009, I participated in a cooking show called MasterChef with Gordon Ramsay. And that really what allowed me to serve me as a trampoline to then jump into the culinary world. Because this guy had said that I could cook and everyone believed him.
Okay. And could you cook at that time or you learned while doing?
Oh, no. I mean, I'm sorry. At least in my generation, right? Like, I don't want to. You as a, you know, the girl in a house of women, because I had all sisters, all aunties, you know, at any given time, there were 9 women in my house and our dog was a girl too. You always learn how to cook. You're always in the kitchen. I learned how to cook from my grandma and then also my mother. But with my grandma, like sorting beans to soak them overnight or shredding the meats or cutting the vegetables, peeling the tubers. Mm-hmm. And so I had a passion for food since a very young age. Mm-hmm. In grad school, I was known as Mama V because I always showed up to our study groups with a casserole, with a tray of cookies, you know, like I've always used food as a way to connect with others. And so it was really a lucky, you know, like they say a life curve that somehow I was able to use it to make something off of it.
I would like to take the jump then to, you know, the low carbon cookbook that you wrote. You wrote it after the show?
Or I did, or? Many years. Yeah. 10 years. Oh, after 10. The show.
Okay.
Okay. Yeah. Okay. And so another testament, right, that this is something that was always in my head. Sustainability, despite all my career changes, from architecture to urban planning, mm-hmm. now I go into cooking. The one common denominator that I've always had is how our actions impact the land that we stand on, and specifically mm-hmm. Mother Earth, right? I have such respect for Mother Earth and the planet that we live in. And so it was only normal that when I started cooking, I brought that foundation with me of, you know, being sustainability minded. And so because not everyone, and especially 10, 12 years ago, no one really was talking about food waste or the kind of food that we eat or biodiversity. You know, as long as you put a plate of delicious food in front of someone, which usually had more than half the plate being a cut of meat, no one really cared about these things. But because food insecurity is part of my story, mm-hmm. I do. I care. I care about where, first of all, having the food, having access and to the food, and that the food is affordable. But also, how are we not like bringing these ingredients that Mother Earth is plentifully mm-hmm. providing for us? How are we not putting these on our plate? And so here's what happened. Mm. I had gone to many publishers with my idea, and no one was really buying my book. The idea or the concept of my book. I wrote a beautiful proposal. It was 56 pages long with sample chapters, and no one was going for it. I had meetings, I was closed, I never sold it. And then COVID hit. Mm. And then we finally had like a tangible evidence that the food that we put in our mouths has an effect, and it could be an effect on humans, planetary mm-hmm. health, right? And so that conversation started to become a little more normalized. Mm-hmm. And it was in July of 2020 that I finally got a publisher to understand the value of my idea. Mm-hmm. And it was, you know, DK Books, part of the Penguin Random House. And they signed me for my first book right in the middle of the pandemic. Now, I must share with you that I found out that I was being signed to write my first book ever at the same time that I just found out that weekend that I was pregnant with my first child.
Wow.
So I grew and birthed two babies simultaneously.
That's a great story. Yeah. Tell us, because I started reading it, and what I find fascinating about this cookbook is that it is much more than, you know, just a regular book with recipes. No, you clearly have a message for the reader. It's educational. Tell maybe in your own words what you hope this book will do.
You first of all might see that the book title on the book, it says the Low Carbon Cookbook, mm-hmm. but if you were to go buy it, it's listed as the Low Carbon Cookbook and Action Plan. The reason why sometimes the covers get designed before the book is finished, and by the time the book was finished and having about one quarter of the book being more like that textbook, you know, data mm-hmm. with actionable steps on how to minimize our own carbon footprint, the publisher became more and more interested in mm-hmm. extending that name, as in to let people know that not just you have 140 plus sustainable recipes, but there's also the data and the science behind why do we or should we eat this way. For me, that was also very important because my cookbook is very specific. Yes, of course, you can go and buy a can of coconut milk to add to your curry recipe. Mm-hmm. But at a, especially at a time where COVID hits and, you know, like we were having food supply issues, there was really a time where we started to understand how fragile our food systems were. Mm-hmm. I posed the question like, well, what if, yes, someone can go and buy the can of coconut milk, but what if I show someone how to make it at home, how to make coconut cream at home? And so if I'm going to tell you that you have to eat a wide variety of vegetables and make things from scratch and minimize your carbon footprint, not just by what you eat, but how you cook it, how you store it, how much or how little that you weigh, mm-hmm. I need to tell people why that's important. And I'm very fortunate that at that time, I had already started being involved with some science-based, you know, organizations. Yeah. At that time, it was the Eat Lancet report. We're up working side by side with scientists that are telling me, you know, these are the facts, this is the data, and how can, you know, you can unlearn what you've seen. And I wanted to make this data digestible, so to speak, for people. Because the moment that I saw that data, the moment that I understood that, you know, a third, this was one scary data fact. By the time I wrote the book, it was about 26% of all greenhouse gas generation in our world came from food production, food consumption. Mm. By the time the book was published, that data had already increased to 34%, over one third in a 1.5 year time. These facts for me are alarming, but also it means that us as individuals, as consumers, as home cooks, as people that eat, mm-hmm. we have a lot of power in our hands to make a difference.
Wow. No, and it's really well done. You know, clearly written, explained, and you, yeah. I mean, when you go through the book, you understand, and you get also, at least what happened with me, I, you know, you get motivated in terms of, oh yeah. So because, you know, Alejandra, what I often talk about with my guest is, you know, many of us know that we have set a lot of challenges, but we feel overwhelmed, you know, where do we start? And I think for many, I have to admit, I'm more an eater than a cook person, but you know, many a cook. So it's something that's doable. And to start changing your own behavior, and then inspiring, you know, the rest as well. So that's wonderful. Tell us, what is happening with the book now? Because you're still speaking a lot about it. What is happening with you? Yeah.
Right. And I think the book, has always been relevant. I just don't think that out there people were ready to understand really the daunting effects of food. Mm-hmm. So some people like to say that my book was ahead of its time, mm-hmm. you know? And so the book is still relevant. The book is being still talked about, thankfully. And the more data that comes out, the more that it corroborates not just what I talk about, but the intention, which is like, I just want to help get people excited about eating plants. Mm-hmm. I don't think that there is one specific diet that is what's going to save the world. I'm saying, you're an omnivore. Are you a pescatarian? Are you a lacto-ovo-vegetarian? Great. Eat more vegetables. Put more colorful vegetables on your plate. Eat vegetables that you normally don't cook with so that you can help promote the biodiversity. Mm. Be mindful of how you discard or use, hopefully the latter, those peels that you're getting, you know, once you prepare your veggies, or the carrot greens, or the radish greens, or the papaya seeds. Like, let's have that conversation. Let's normalize food waste. So I think I want to have a table that is very inclusive and where everyone feels invited to partake and also to take action and responsibility for.
I mean, two things happened last week when I met you. Is first of all, I was exposed to your food, which I went three or four times to your dessert. That was so good. And then, you know, I heard you speak and yeah, so clear and something, oh, you know, this is doable. This is great. And because I also had eaten your food, then you also know, okay, and it still tastes good. It looks good and it tastes good, right? Right. It's something you mentioned last week to me. You wanted to be nutritious and delicious.
Yes.
Yeah.
Food has to be delicious. Otherwise, it doesn't matter how sustainable it is or how healthy, you know, people are not going to go for it. Mm-hmm. So it has to be delicious first. But I want to go back for a moment to what you talked about the sustainable development goals. I am a true believer. I'm a big fan of the SDGs. In fact, I'm an ambassador for sustainable development too. Sustainable development goal number two.
And
zero hunger, for those that are not familiar. I have also advocated heavily for sustainable development one, but I think that food is linked to all 17 of them. I think that whether we're talking about responsible consumption or, you know, food is somehow linked to all of our sustainable development goals. And so as it touches so many of them, if we take an individual action and a personal accountability to make a difference, we can change and contribute to the achievement of all of them. That's number one. Number two is people often think like, there's not enough that I can do to make a difference. I'm green. I'm a little more sustainable. I started using plastic, paper straws instead of plastic. It's great, but it's just not enough, you know? So making small changes in our homes, in our daily lives, it could have a big impact as part of a collective effort. In Venezuela, we have a saying that if everyone contributes a small grain of sand, like, you can build a mountain. And I think putting that idea in people's heads hopefully will inspire them and empower them to just start making small changes. No one, you know, asking you to, you know, fast for 3 days. We're just saying, you know, eat more vegetables, be more mindful of the food that you weigh, hopefully reduce your red meat intake somewhat, you know, especially that one, like 50%, and eat other proteins. If protein is what you want to, animal protein is what you want to eat.
I really love that you continue to piggyback on the sustainable development goals, because that's also very important to me. What I always say, you know, yes, they are not perfect, but, you know, it's what we discuss together and what we have. So I'm really happy that you lifted it up. And yes, SDG 2 is also important for me. I mean, I told you that this particular podcast is a spin-off of my 100-mile walk, which I started in 2012, where I try to raise money and awareness around, you know, hunger, poverty, SDG 1. As well as injustice. So I really appreciate what you said. Alejandra, I don't know if you're familiar with the inner development goals, but I would like to talk a bit about that, because, you know, you know that we are on average only at 15% or something around, you know, in reaching the SDGs, and we are in 2024 and we, you know, we have 6 years more to go, right? And a growing group of people around the world is saying, you know, one of the reasons that we are failing or not making the progress that we need to make are because, okay, the SDGs focus on systems and processes that need to change. But what we are forgetting is that we need to work on the ability, skills, and knowledge as an individual and as a community to, you know, to reach, to work on those system changes. So they did a survey and they came up with 5 inner development goals. And the first a goal is being, thinking, relating, collaborating, and acting. So 5 goals. I don't know. So I have 2 questions maybe around it. One is, have you heard about the inner development goals? And if not, does it matter? But if you hear that, you know, being, thinking, relating, collaborating, and acting, working on things like empathy, critical thinking, are really important to, you know, when we want to achieve those SDGs. Yeah, what is your reply?
Yeah. Okay. So the honest truth is I had not heard about them. But I did see a link related to your podcast, and so I quickly linked into it. And and they're great. And you know, in a very personal note, until I was willing and able to look within, mm-hmm. And to have a better connection with myself, with my self as an individual, with my brain, my spirit, I really wasn't able to develop some of the skills you talked about, like empathy or relatability or connection. It took me a long time to get here and to understand that what I thought were isolated aspects of my life, of my academic education, of my professional journey, of my personal growth journey, including being a mother. And now I remember about 10 years ago, a good friend of mine said, I know that you don't think that these things are related, but now, you know, this is a time when I was losing like a third career, right? Mm-hmm. And now I have to build something again with way too many student loans to make me see what it was for. And he said, but right when you feel like your life is falling apart, your life is coming back together. And so this is to say that understanding the concept of being and thinking and relating and collaborating and ultimately connecting to take an action towards something greater than ourselves has been the key of my adult life, even when I wasn't aware that that's what was happening. And I can even link that, because, you know, ten years ago me would be like, that's a bunch of, you know, blah blah blah. Mm-hmm. I can still wait. So I studied architecture, which is not related to food, but I was already thinking about sustainability. Also, architecture helped me to understand the concepts of you know, mapping out goals to come together as something tangible. Like form follows function. It's a very popular concept in architecture school. And I was able to learn diagrams. And then I go into planning and I bring the sustainability element. And I'm like, oh yeah, so how we, you know, how we build, how we cover the cap of Mother Earth, whether we let water, you know, storm water drain and percolate through this or not, then we affect the under, you know, bed and irrigation systems. And, oh, by the way, they also affect people and communities and historic preservation and facades and the meaning that it has for people and culture and the way that we relate each other. And, you know, I have to plug in Jane Jacobs, who wasn't a planner, but she talked about like the beauty of the street theater and how people intersect with each other on the streets and how meaningful it is. And then I go into food and I'm like, oh, wait. And this is also related to the way we grow our food and how, whether we fertilize or not, has a huge impact on the plants that grow and the food that we eat, and it gets us healthy or not. And by the way, that also affects the environment and climate change and global warming. And so it is all related. And I'm just grateful that I had the willingness and the open mind to see it, so that then now it's like it actually becomes very clear, and it gives me such a sense of purpose. Because on one end, I understand that these are all moving parts, but they're all linked by one core. And that unless we are able to collaborate and work together, we're doomed. And there's no planet B. So we just have to collaborate. That's why I love the SDGs, even their logo. Like, it's just very, you know, it makes it clear for me. And I hope that wasn't too much. I was just trying to say how, like, maybe for your story that could look completely different, but if you're able to see the connection, maybe it will make sense as a whole.
I do think that we should have realized, and I think we did realize, especially during COVID, that every, you know, that we are all interconnected. And unfortunately, you know, especially people in the West who then, you know, those who had were able to get access to vaccines, you know, thought only about themselves. So you know, but for 2 weeks when there was no solution, then everybody was like, oh, we're in the same boat. It turned out to be, you know, I don't think we were in the same boat. We were in the same storm. We had different boats, right? So you know, thank you for that. And my listeners know I am very passionate about SDGs as well, and especially SDG 2. And that's not only for, you know, countries outside of the US, but also within the US. And you know, yesterday we my organization was part of a launch of and it's really cool, different NGOs of different faith backgrounds, you know, Muslims, Jews, Christian, secular, where they work together on helping to lift up the national strategy on health and nutrition, on hunger, nutrition, and health, through this coalition. And for me, that was such a light, because there is so much polarization at the moment. There are so many problems, right? But at least here, different organizations with different backgrounds, you know, came together with one voice. And so that's what I also appreciate of all the work that you do in you know, okay, maybe you don't have to agree always, but there are things that we should be doing together, and especially for future generations. I mean, yesterday we mentioned that in the US, which is unbelievable, one in five children are food insecure, right? That's unacceptable for a country like this, I think. So we're not even talking about, nutrition, where you always, we talked about school feeding, and you know, children learning to eat, you know, nutritious food, right? Yeah, because they tend to be like sweets. It's also what we market in supermarkets, right? So, you know, always on the height of the children, we put the sweets. Tell a bit about how you are trying to tackle that with your own son.
With my own son to like another degree. I just wanted to share a little like story or journey, because even before I became a mother, you know, a couple of years before COVID, I felt the need to, again, having been food insecure, having that be a cause of lifelong health issues, I felt the need to give back to the community and to try to like address this issue before it got started. And you talked about the stats about food insecurity. At least in the county of Los Angeles, where I live, 1 in 4 Latino children are diagnosed with type 2 diabetes before the age of 8. And so I, again, now anytime something is like frustrating or alarming, I said, well, I have to take action. And so what I did is I started seeking partners. Eventually, I was very grateful to find the support of a local Whole Foods market. And I started going to community centers in my area and teaching free cooking classes for little children. And so I would bring these ingredients. It was sad to say, okay, what is this? And it was a pear, and have little kids like scratch their heads because they had no idea what that was. And so to understand, like, I need to expose these children to the variety of food and fruits and vegetables. And yeah, they were young. They were usually between 6 and 9. So I couldn't really put a stove in front of them. But I was like, how about we make healthy snacks? And so I would make like rice cake, and instead of using refined sugars and jams, I would use like raw honey or some healthy nut butter for those that were able to eat them, and maybe some berries. And so they'll make this beautiful little like tart for like an after school snack. And now they're also learning how to make food themselves, and so it's a great skill to have. And it was so sweet and so rewarding to see their little faces of like, how good is this? And so like understanding that a lot of times it's access or lack of access, but mm-hmm. also simply, you know, you don't know what you don't know. When it comes to my son, I was so mindful, you know, as an older mother, and I was just so grateful that I had the opportunity to breastfeed at my age. I birthed him when I was 47. Mm. That was a miracle on its own, but that I was able to breastfeed him. I've always cherished that opportunity because I knew how important it would be as a foundation of his nutrition, you know, and health journey. And I'm just really mindful of what I put in front of him, you know, like, that child did not even know what sugar was until he started going to preschool. Mm-hmm. And sure enough, it's a comedic thing. The first picture that I get back from his preschool after he had never tasted sugar is a picture of him like going face first into a cupcake and like, you know, the frosting mm-hmm. is all over his face. And I was like, no, I made him a watermelon cake for his first birthday. I don't know if you know what that is, but it was beautiful. Yeah, it was made out of watermelon. Mm-hmm. So I now also understand that there is somewhat of a balance that, you know, that is the exception. The rule is how I feed him at home. And this morning I made him, he just turned 3, you know.
So congratulations,
thank you. I made him a Dino smoothie, and is a smoothie that I put spinach, probiotic yogurt, blueberries, blackberries, a little bit of banana, some mango, chia seeds, flax seeds, hemp seeds, and it turns into this greenish, you know, dino smoothie. And as he drinks, I just think it's this yummy, you know, sweet treat. I just know that it's nourishing his body and his mm-hmm. brain and his development. And that just really fills me with gratitude because I have access to that now.
That's great. Yeah, I you explained it last time to me about the pancakes as well. It's awesome. I'm not complaining about the food that I took, you know, when I was going to school, but it sounds awesome to have you as the mom and the chef. So. hey, Alejandra, I always have a couple of questions that I would like to ask,
yeah.
You know, that I would also ask if we would really walk in person with each other, you know, would walk yeah. together the 15 to 20 miles per day to reach the 100 mile. So when I walk, then I often talk with, if I'm accompanied by somebody else about, you know, why am I walking? You know, what is life about, right? And then there is often a discussion about religion and spirituality. And then we talk about the youth. I'm just fascinated by hearing from people. What do you see happening in your community with youth and religion and spirituality? Because some people are saying, oh, you know, these younger generation not going to church anymore. They're not spiritual. Others say, no, they might not be religious, but they're still spiritual. Depends also on which country where, you know. So, but what do you see in Los Angeles, in your community, happening right. with youth and spirituality?
Right. And I think I should sort of like clarify that my current community mm-hmm. is, you know, a lot of people my age probably have children in high school and such, but my immediate community really is parents of young children.
Yeah, sure.
And so my response will be skewed because, you know, we're dealing with, you know, the three, maybe I have got children that are, you know, 8 or 9. Mm-hmm. So, you know, it's a little bit younger maybe than what you normally talk about. And on a very personal note, I grew up very religious, yet now I identify as a very spiritual person as opposed to someone that is involved with a particular mm-hmm. religion. And I had to go through a journey of like extreme darkness and need and desperation to seek out that connection again, going back to mm-hmm. the connection to a higher power, which now sets me on a place where I am connected. I am connected mm. to a power greater than me. And I believe in the divine interventions that opens me up to. And because I've seen the light and the darkness. It's so important for me that my son grows up knowing that there is something that is, you know, divine and protecting us and guiding us. Because as an older mother, I can only hope that I am in his life for many years to come. But if I'm ever not in this plane, I want him to have that as a resource for life, because I know that in the darkest times for me, if I hadn't had hope, which now I can look back and call it faith, but I didn't know that, you know, I may have not made it. So, you know, in my immediate community, there's this strong belief that, you know, that the community element is tied up to a spirituality, you know. And so my child has godparents, and I know that they will care for him as I do. I have got children that I am so involved in their lives, and I see that this allows them to tap into our culture, our cultural traditions, our community, but also to that tool for life that that gives you a sense of certainty, a sense of belonging, and a sense of feeling protection from the divine. Great.
No, that's beautiful, and thank you for sharing that. You have used the word, you know, connecting many times. I also, well, I'm connecting you with my listeners. I would like to connect you with my previous guest. So I have a question for you from the previous guest. And that question is...
if you could do a little elevator pitch on what your legacy for the world would be in a sentence, what would it be?
Ooh, I'm a woman of many words, so one sentence. I think to that I would answer that I want to be remembered by my passion for sustainability and the determination to help deliver better food systems for all. I would want to be also like the inspiration for some people to cook in a way that it's healthy for them, but also for the planet.
Your question for the next guest.
What drives your passion?
Okay. What drives your passion? Music is very important to me. So I always have a question about music as well. If I ask you to mention a song or a piece of music that embodies, for the big part, what you are about, which song or piece of music would that be, and why?
Oh my goodness. Well, you know what? This will bring me back to my roots. There is a song called Mi Querencia, and it's by a very popular singer in Venezuela, Simon Diaz, who is no longer with us. And it talks about, first of all, it talks about like the humble things that we can love and that can define us. Also, the humble thing that we adore that makes us want to come back home. And I have two homes. You know, Venezuela will forever be ingrained in me. I say, you know, you can get a girl out of Venezuela, but you can get Venezuela out of the girl. You know, 20-something years later, I still find myself like living true to the values and the principles and the cultural traditions that I grew up with. And it's so hard to not necessarily always miss, because home is truly where the heart is. I have a husband that I love and adore, and a child that now makes it really home. But I will always have this this place that I grew up in, where I can remember the smell of the Araguanay trees and the smell when you drive into the coast, and like, you know, these smells and visions, you know, from Mi Querencia, it's really illustrative of that.
I think you're the third chef that is part of the show. I've never asked this question though, but when I was listening to you, I was thinking, okay, I should ask this question. If I ask you to name one dish that best embodies what you are about, which dish would it be? Would it be and why?
Oh my gosh, there's absolutely no doubt. El pabellón criollo is the national dish of Venezuela. Mm-hmm. And the dish on itself, it tells a story. And pabellón criollo, it translates literal to Creole pavilion. And it doesn't mean much in English, right? But it's really a representation of the journey that our country had, because it has ingredients that were brought during the colonization, that were influenced by the slaves that came. Mm-hmm. I am an Afro-Latina, so I'm true to both the indigenous and the African, like, journey, you know, of our becoming our own country. It has the rice, and it has the plantain, mm-hmm. and it has black beans, and it has an arepa, which is like our national bread, which is made out of corn. And ultimately, it has a shredded beef that even as a non-meat eater, as you probably tasted at the event mm-hmm. at the New York Botanical Gardens, now I can make with a food waste ingredient, which is plantain peel.
Oh, yes. That was so... that was absolutely great. Okay. Wow. Yes, it's really a pity that we don't do these, podcast recordings, you know, in person, so I can ask you, could we make this maybe? That's great. Thank you for sharing that. These conversations always go fast. I still would like to ask you, do you have any message or invitation or question for the listeners?
Yes, I think that for me, it's always really important to remind individuals in general that our actions matter, that our actions have a consequence, and it's up to us whether that consequence is positive or negative, that there is no planet B, and that we all have to work together to regenerate our planet, to improve our food systems, to become catalysts for change and spur equality, whether it's for nutrition, health, I think they're so important. And so that if we use our platforms, our communities, our churches, our social media, like to ignite that and propagate that message, I think, it could be so powerful. Mm. So, I just think that taking that accountability and that personal responsibility to ignite change, we no longer can afford to look the other way and think selfishly, like, well, I have food in my fridge. I have, a shelter to live under, because all of that can be very fragile and very temporary. And I think that it's time that we also help others that don't have the voice, or don't have the plate of food, or that don't have the means. And I think it would just lead to a life that is much more fulfilling, full of connection. Mm.
No, I can attest to that. I mean, you really walk the talk, and that it's not only talk, it's definitely walking as well. Any plans for a follow-up book, the next book, you know?
Yeah, I'm actually working on my second book right now. Mm-hmm. It's still in the same realm of sustainable food. I am just excited to venture out with even, you know, newer ingredients, always trying to get people excited to try something that they haven't tried before. Also to connect with other cultural culinary traditions for the sake of inclusiveness. Mm-hmm. And and this is very linked to, I have an upcoming TED Talk early this August, and
it's exciting.
All related to sustainable food, and just to, I think it's important for me to make people understand that we don't, you know, that the change doesn't have to be life changing, that we can make small changes in our daily lives, and that can have a huge impact. And a lot of times people are like, okay, but what is that? And so, you know, giving people like actionable items and few ideas that they can implement at home.
Great. We are looking forward to the book as well as to the TED Talk. And any question that I should have asked but did not ask before we close?
I think you asked a lot of really good questions. Let me see. Oh, okay. So I think one thing that we didn't touch on was that in this connectivity of planet, food, health, environment, we didn't really touch on the importance of a microenvironment that lives within us, which is our gut. Mm-hmm. So that's a huge part of my focus. Probably the reason why there's no refined sugars on my book, because I am a mental health patient myself, and I want to normalize this stigma associated with mental health. Because as it is true that I had to connect to something greater than me for help, I also had to eat in a way that supported my mental health. Mm. And that is taking care of our gut. So our gut, our intestine, and some people call it our second brain, we need to feed the good bacteria. And that means eating a lot of fibers and eating the rainbow, eating as many different colors from what Mother Earth has to offer us, from vegetables, fruits, seeds, nuts, algae, mushrooms, and fungi, especially legumes, beans, lentils, carob, tamarind, you know, so many amazing ingredients, part of the legumes. And all of that brings fibers, probiotics, prebiotics, and phytochemicals with anti-inflammatory and inflammatory and antioxidant properties, which help our gut become healthier, and that has a huge impact on our mental health. So yet another link to the connection, because then I would say this is like the closing statement, right? Like the same food that is good for our health, for the planet and climate change. For biodiversity, for the livelihoods of the people that work the land, is also good for our mental health. And so it is all connected.
Right. Yeah, I would like to thank you for sharing your experiences, your wisdom, awesome suggestions and how to improve our diet and you know, contribute to making this world a bit better, a lot better. So thank you for everything you do, and
thank you. I appreciate the opportunity to chat with you, and I'm just really excited also like to see what the next guest has to say and bring to the table.
me too. Thanks Alejandra.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to Walk, Talk, Listen.
please check us out on 100mile.org or follow us on Facebook or Instagram.